properly. Mm-hmm. Okay, there it is. All right, well, welcome to D's Practice Pod. Today I have Napoleon Revels Bay. Did I say that correctly?
You sure did.
Okay. He is a music educator as well as a player. As you guys know by now, I like to try to have guests on that have different experiences than I do. And he certainly has. He's had a vast career thus far. So let's get right into it and start talking to the man.
Right.
Okay. Okay, well, when did you start playing?
I started playing when I was about the age of 16, which was considered late to play music, even though my parents, excuse me, had given me piano lessons early on. But I didn't take music serious until about 16, and then I studied privately. And I never took it in school, I only studied privately.
Right, right. Okay. What was your inspiration to start?
To start?
Yes. What gave you the bug?
What gave me the bug to play music? I think it was because at that time that there was a lot of creativity in the music in the 60s anyway. So I think all of us at some point, you know, we hear music, but that doesn't mean we're going to want to play music. And then we might want to play music for fun or something like that, just a, you know, a groupie thing or something. But sometimes then some of us gravitate to, well, I want to study this and maybe try and do something more of it as far as playing is concerned.
Right.
So I think in my case, I heard music and I always liked music. And then I said, oh, I like to take music lessons. And so my father, you know, afforded me a $6 drum lessons at that time. And that's how I got started.
Yeah, $6. I remember those days. Well, mine started at, I think, $11.
I think it was, I don't even know if it was an hour or a half hour. I don't remember how long my lesson was, you know, at that point. That's how I got started.
Well, back in the day, it probably was a little looser than it is now. Now it's more, you know, a lot more stringent. And, you know, I took lessons from Al Miller for
right, you told me. Yeah, Al,
17 mm-hmm. years, approximately.
Wow. And,
well, he had that real strict German work ethic thing, mm-hmm. so he got you down to the last minute. And, you know.
And I studied with Charlie Perry.
Right.
Who, Perry... You know, he was a real nice guy. I always liked going to Perry's house, you know. It was always fun. He was always grinning right. and, you know, and laughing in a little bit and carrying on. And so Perry, I guess, at that time I was in high school and whatnot, I always knew about certain musicians. But then it was through him that I sort of honed and, you know, studied the styles, I guess, of the
right.
musicians that he liked at that point. And he was writing the books. But we always heard both sides of the coin. I mean, and then when I started playing... I was playing pop music, you know, I was playing, you know, some R&B. And,
right.
But I always liked yeah. jazz. So it was between right. the jazz and the R&B
right.
situation.
Right, right. It's good to be able to connect with a teacher. That's what you try to do with your students.
Yeah.
You try to have that personal connection,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you feel, firstly, you'll see them for longer. You know,
yeah.
I personally like to keep my students on... till they go to college, if I can,
mm-hmm.
you know. I'm successful sometimes. Other times, the kid picks up a football or something during the summertime.
True.
And then sometimes that's all she wrote.
Yeah, between sports and art. Right?
Well, you know, sometimes they can coexist. Sometimes they can't.
Yeah, and I think nowadays it's a little different compared to maybe before, where some students, they get turned on to music, but they don't really think about it. It's just, I just want to have some fun and go home. And so the students you wind up having, at least the ones I had, they were, I would never consider them maybe want to be players because they wanted to just get over a little bit and that's it. And then one boy, I don't forget, he came back after he really started wanting to play. He realized then the value of taking music lessons because he couldn't accomplish his goals. So now I want to learn how to play, you know,
right.
to really study and understand. And then after that, now I got to go to college. Well, now, I got to like get into that. So, you know, in New York, they have NISMA, so it's kind of interesting. I never grew up with that NISMA thing. And that didn't ever happen until I came off the road and whatnot, and I found out students with this thing called NISMA. So even myself, I had to go back and, you know, sharpen up and understand and all those reading skills, levels and stuff. But it was good. It was good for me. It was like going back to school again, which was a good thing.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And so the guys I had, but some of them I would never think were going to be so-called professionals. I only got one And he, in fact, he texted me the other day. No, I saw him on Facebook because he said he's going to his first NAMM show. So, I mean, that's one out of maybe thousands. Because a lot of guys get disillusioned or whatever. And I don't think the music industry, not necessarily is made for everybody, but they might not have the tenacity, you know, to be a musician like that.
You're right. It's something that it's got to be a live or die thing.
Yeah.
To really.
And sometimes you might be dying. He said, oh, no. Mom was right. Oh, son, that's nice. But maybe just give yourself a job.
I've never had a student where their parents didn't have a plan B for them, even if they did have aspirations, you know?
Well, if they come to me, I would tell them this. I'm never going to discourage you from playing, because then you'll wind up like some teachers I met. They were always... they were always like irritable a little bit because, see, they never played. They took these lessons and stuff. They went straight into teaching because they wanted to use whatever skills they got. But some of them were like kind of rough on their students, like, you know. And I thought that was horrible that you would discourage a student to play, because once you begin to play a little bit, then their life, you know, they can make the balance between can I make an income out of this thing and still feel satisfied because I did play this music?
Right.
And it's like a sports. Other than we don't get contracts like that. But it's like a sport thing because, you know, we keep going and going and going. We're only good as the last time we played and stuff like that. So it really takes a certain type of tenacity to want to be a musician and to be persistent. And for me, I always had in my mind, I was going to either sweep the floor, sell records in a record store, or whatever it took to stay in the music.
Right.
Stay around the music. I met a lady, I'll never forget, she's a violinist. And hey, man, she got up being working for an entertainment lawyer.
Right.
So those are the things I'm trying to encourage my students to stay. As long as you can stay around it some kind of way. I know a guy I worked for, ASCAP, you know. They went to school for music. So at least you're still around the music and you can still practice and do whatever you do. And, you know, still play. You know, it's a good thing.
Well, yeah, that brings me to, firstly, tell me a little bit about some of your playing experiences. Like, start from when you first started really passionately playing, started playing professionally. Some of the people you've played with, some good experiences.
Mm-hmm. Bear too? No.
Yes, absolutely. I've been trying for a while to start one called Hell Gigs, but a lot of guys don't want to do it because they're afraid of angering some club owners that, you know.
Well, when I got started at 16, I was almost playing already because, you know, like I said, there was a scene to play, just to play.
Right.
And I was fortunate because my father was in the radio and television, so he knew a lot of artists would come by, or local players that fixed their equipment or whatever the case might be. And so I got started here on Long Island, strange enough. Little Buster, people might know, remember Little Buster, but he was like a local legend around here on Long Island. But I didn't really play with Buster directly, but, you know, there were groups that were playing around the island. So I played, you know, and I was fortunate. In Hempstead, there was a place called Stereo Lounge. And they, at that point, a lot of the players that lived on Long Island would get local gigs, and you could meet them that way, too. So, Seldon Powell was one who, he wasn't a name known musician amongst, I guess, like a star, but they were working musicians. They worked for CBS, NBC, and all that. They were doing like studio gigs, record dates, and all kind of stuff like that.
A journeyman.
Through Perry, who knew a lot of those players too, Bud Johnson and stuff. His grandson's the one of the rappers that just died. But in any case, so because of the community was so rich with musicians, you had a chance to play and work.
Right.
And so there's a lot of little clubs and things of that nature. So Arthur Prysox and people like that, they all lived on Long Island, and Brooke Benton's and people like that. And there was a lot of clubs to play. So you wound up playing with somebody that knew somebody that knew somebody else. And that's how I got started. So I was fortunate. You could play. In fact, when I went to community college, and I played my way through school. You know, because at that time, you know, it was club dates, weddings, wedding bands, all that kind of stuff. Like, you could play Friday, double Saturdays, double Sundays and stuff. So you made some money and you still could play. That was nice to make some money. I wasn't looking at for me. I was looking at a good chance to play, you know.
Sure.
But it was good. That's how we got started.
Well, I'm looking at some information I pulled off your site. I'm seeing some really big names here.
Mm-hmm.
Gladys Knight, Gregory Hines, Aretha Franklin, Cab Calloway.
Yeah. And so those people came about when I wound up getting into the Broadway show thing.
Right.
Because with me, I went to the Navy coming out of high school. I went to Navy because I didn't want to get, be honest with you, I'm not going to lie, man, I didn't want to get hurt, killed over something like that and going to
sure,
war.
Right.
I want to come home in one piece. So when I came out, I studied. In fact, he died, I don't know, maybe 2-3 years ago. Ronnie Gould, who was a percussionist at NASA Community. And Ronnie Gould, I think you told Rob Murgerstein too. I think he was one of his students. So Ronnie Gould was there and at Community, and then I transferred to Old Westbury. Right. Through Old Westbury is how I met Warren Smith, who I honored today, because Warren and them, they were like your friends. They right. were my teachers, but they were like my friends.
Yes.
And so he was like a father to all these percussionists and players and stuff.
Right.
So through him, I met Max Rose, Oom Boom, all the and Warren was teaching at Old Westbury, where I went to. And then at the same time, he was playing full-time. He was doing Broadway. He was one of the original Broadway players on West Side Story when he got out of college at Manhattan.
Right.
So he had, the city at Studio Wiz was where I met all the players at, because they have rehearsals there, all this kind of stuff like that. So when he was doing, not only was doing Broadway shows, doing record dates, I never going in with Hubert Laws when he did Amazing Grace, and it came out, and I said, wow, I was in the studio when he did that. You know, because Warren was percussionist, and he's like one of the first called percussionists. So he had all
right.
this work. So he played percussion and drums. So I went to him to study percussion and drums. So through him, I was a student. They knew me, oh, you're one of Warren's students. So when it came around to get to offer jobs, that's how I got in, because Warren said, oh, you can recommend my students.
Right.
And so through that, went on the road with Bubbling Brown Sugar, Ain't Misbehaving UB, and all these people that I met that came through the Broadway thing. But I didn't grow up to be a Broadway player. It's just that's how it right. happened. And I'm glad it did happen, because out of that, I'll be honest with you, it was great to get vested in the union and get a stipulated paycheck.
That was the question I had. Are you a union member?
Yeah, yeah. I joined the union. I joined the union when I was 16 anyway. But I never, I guess I thought it was hip to join the union.
Right.
But I only went down to a few calls. At that time, the union did have the calls,
Right.
So you go down there and, oh, I need a drummer over here. I need a drummer. But I never really got called like that. I think I got maybe one or two gigs when I went in town. And then I went to the local out here. But you really had to live in the city.
Yeah, which is no longer.
Yeah, the one out here.
About a year ago, maybe two.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah. When I was planning on joining,
yeah.
I went down there and it's all.
Gone. Yeah.
So local. Now you got to go to Manhattan.
Yeah, local 802. Again, because us living on Long Island was much different if you're in town.
Right.
But I found, and I never did, but I found the advantages. You really need to be in Manhattan, because you could roll out of bed and see all the guys you read about in the magazines and books, actors, actresses, they're all over the place, because everybody's in the city.
Right.
So that's what happened. I never went into the city like that, but through Warren, I got a chance to hang a lot and
right.
meet a lot of the players and knew this one, I was playing with this one, I was playing with that one. And that's how you get to know. And when Warren did, to me, was one of the biggest, I was excited when Warren worked with Tony Williams Lifetime,
mm-hmm.
So I'm going to sort of meet Tony. So I did meet him, once in a while, I would see him and stuff like that. And he was playing with Miles and stuff. So that's how everybody sort of got to the circuit.
Right.
When somebody knows somebody that knows somebody that knows somebody. And
yeah.
It's about hanging out and meeting guys and, John McLaughlin. I met Billy Cobham in the studio. And he said, oh, yeah, man, I'm playing with this band tonight on my father's place. First time we're playing, it's Mahavishnu Orchestra, right?
Right.
So I go in there
right.
and I say, oh, wow. And I never forget it. Right. Intermountain Flame was their first album they made. I was right. there when they played at my father's place. Dun, 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 dun.
When there was a real serious scene still here on the island.
Yeah, yeah. So I saw Billy, that's how I met him. Then I just saw him last year at the NAMM show. I was telling him how we met at the NAMM, and I told him how I met. But he was doing a lot of record days and sessions and stuff. So because everybody was doing something, so you could meet all the players.
Sure.
And there was a lot of record dates going on at the time. So you could meet a lot of players. It wasn't, I think today is a little bit more scattered, and there's really no record contracts like that anymore. But that's how you sort of met the players. Now I think you got to make a few extra steps to meet the players that doing the things that you want to do and try and get to know them and,
It's a weird life now, because we have this technology.
Mm-hmm.
We have more resources to do it yourself if mm-hmm. you wanted to, yet it's never been more difficult to make a living.
Yeah, but at the other end, the bar has been lowered so that we can get in. Unfortunately, this lowered. Lowered mean that, okay, now you and I can make a CD and not have to go into a studio.
Right.
But it lowers it for anybody can make a CD, and then you get judged on the criteria of I'm not saying popular music, but the music gets watered down, so it's not, you don't have to know anything to get in and do it. You can YouTube.
It's true.
You don't have to really know anything. Where I had to grow up, I had to play some you know, parallels and all that kind of stuff like that, so, right. So I could hone my skills up. But you're not just on that. You're just on the quality of what people, what is now considered to be the music that people are, quote unquote, listening to. So at some point, it's open, but it is narrow because people only come up hearing one thing. And even when I was growing up, I mean, I love James Brown. I still do today. It's just that we heard all this other stuff that I said, oh, well, I want to play that. I'm going to do this. I'm going to try that. Where now it's like you're almost locked in. You got to play one type of stuff. And if you start stretching a little bit, people say, well, I don't like that because now you're not popular anymore, you know. So at it's the other true. End, I it's think true. I tell guys, you know, play what you like to play. But as a player, really, you're not going to have a good palette of music to play with. It's like an artist. If I'm only got one color, which is green, well, no, you don't have green stuff. But maybe you say, well, I want some blue, I want some orange, I want some yellow. So that means you go listen to different stuff. And I'll take a quote that I learned really from Miles. He said, I don't have to know how to play country western, but just listen to it. Because you might want to have that feeling, or that color, right. of it sounds country. I want that country right. sound and feeling. Sure. So now today, it's like, man, the sky's the limit. You had guys mixing up all types of genres, what they call now world music. Which, right. which is me, it's slick. I love it because I get a chance to hear something that I don't normally do. And I want to learn how to play that. And then incorporate it in right. your playing. And then that's how, it, you know, you grow as a musician.
Well, if you want to take an example of a person who's taken that ball and ran with it, Sting used to play with the Police.
Mm-hmm.
The Police had a specific sound.
Mm-hmm.
Although that sound did evolve,
mm-hmm.
they were still under the constraints of being a band.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
It was a trio, too, right?
Right, it was a trio.
That's right.
Right? And the thing is, when he decided to do his solo stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, like the very first one, he was a jazz player first when he was from England. He's from Newcastle, England.
Right.
And that's how he got his name, was that he had a sweater that was black and yellow, so he kind of looked like a yellow jacket, so somebody called him Sting, and it stuck.
Oh, okay.
You know? But the thing is, he always was a jazz player first. And when he started his solo thing, he started with all heavy hitters.
Yeah,
Omar Hakim and Branford Marsalis.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know?
I saw that band. Oh, I didn't see the band, but I knew Omar when he got the gig.
Right.
Yeah, because Omar is actually from Long Island. He's from Jamaica.
Is he really?
Yeah, he's from Jamaica.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and his father, I remember his father played trombone. His father taught in the college and stuff. And I never forget one time, he said, oh, yeah, my son plays drums. You know, I said, oh, yeah, what's his name? You know, Omar, because I never knew him, you know. He right. said, yeah, he's playing with this group called Weather Report. I said, Weather Report? So I went and saw Omar. I said, whoa.
I've always loved his play. He always looks like he's having a good time.
Yeah.
He's smooth. Nice guy.
Yeah,
nice I've guy. Never met him.
He's a nice guy. Yeah. Nice guy. Lovely person. And he did something that I always cherish him for doing. And I told him to his face a couple of times. He bought his drum. He bought his first teacher a set of drums. I knew his first teacher was Walter Perkins. Walter Perkins, we had jam session in Queens, and Walter used to play there. So one time, Walter's drums were always raggedy, you know. So one time, he had this nice little pearl set. I said, that's nice, man, but you get the pearl drum. And he said, my student gave it to me. It was Omar.
Wow,
he got fun. Pearl and sent him a nice new set of drums. And I never forget him for doing that because it taught me to be humble like that, too. He gave back to his teacher something that he felt that would help his teacher. And I never forgot Omar for his humbleness of doing that. So last time I saw him was at the Long Beach Jazz Fest. I saw him at NAMM. Him and he opened, he emceed for Billy, and they played together. But he played and Billy played, and they talked about. So I guess Pearl had him, you know, talking about. And I saw the new Pearl, the new electronic drum kit they had. I gotta mortgage my house to get that. But
yeah, they've gotten a little pricey. You can either get a car or you can get a drum set.
I got one. I don't even really use the Pearl. I got it's like, oh man, I'm gonna use the electronic kit. I like it, but it's like
you ever use electronics?
I got one 2 years ago, and I got to get back into it. I started programming. I got EG Drummer to program some sounds, and then they have built-in sounds. But I thought of it for two things. One, I said, well, if I want to play live, but then I did the wrong thing. I didn't code my wires when I took them off to be able to redo it again, because a friend of mine told me, you better stop coding your wires so you know A goes to geez. A, B goes to B, yeah. C, C. And so I never did
might
that.
Might as well be in the telephone booth trying to put that thing together.
Yeah, yeah. So I got them, and I like them. And I wanted to write the drum books. I said, maybe I could do it this way so I could actually play the rhythms rather than write them out, even though I'm going to be able to write them out too. And so it works, you know, pretty cool. And then the one cat's online, he's got a nice transcription of all the drummers. So I'm sort of learning that whole technique, how to use it. Plus, right. playing percussion, I wanted to use it for because I got the Hansonic. I only took it on one gig, and I sort of felt okay trying to play it like a Kunga player and a cowbell player or something.
Right,
like
yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I got that one. And then you can hook that up there, too. So, yeah, I like the electronics. It's just trying to figure out how to incorporate it in what you do, whether it be live or studio. I think for me, it's more of a studio thing where I ain't got to worry about overheads, none of that. It's everything, ambience and stuff. I got it right out of the drum kit and making it sound like a real, quote unquote, real set of drums so that a set player can say, oh man, that's not real. That's you know, digital.
Well, they've come a long way with it.
They sure have.
When I first got married, I got married in 93. And
you're a young guy.
Yeah, I'm younger. I bought a set of Roland TD-7s when they first came out.
Wow.
And they were so revolutionary when they first came out that anyone who was even on the fence about buying a pair of these, Bill Messinetti, who used to run the electronics department of the Long Island Drum Center.
So I know Bill. Right. Yeah, man. Yeah, he's in a while.
He's in Pennsylvania now.
Oh, he's in Pennsylvania. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
When he was at the Long Island Drum Center, he had a rep actually do a clinic for anyone who was either had already purchased or was considering purchasing drums. So the first ones were really set up specifically for portability.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, the brain was about the size of a pull-out radio from back in the day, and everything ran off this rack. They were all just the smaller rubber.
Yeah, the little rubber.
You know, thing,
yeah.
So you literally could take your whole drum set in one hand. You know, I had a piece of Masonite. I put all the pedals down there, and I just attached them all to this thing. So, look at this. It used to take me half an hour to an hour to set all this stuff up.
Mm.
And then it was just take it off stage, and then that was it. So for that aspect of it, it was great. I think the world's a little bit more ready for it now.
Mm.
Clubs on Long Island, not ready at all when I went there. Because the big problem was they really didn't have any amplification for us. I mean, they had the PA.
Mm-hmm.
So that's great, but that's going out to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't hear it yourself,
that's right.
You know?
Yeah.
So they didn't have like a little wedge like the guys playing guitar in the front would have or anything. So you had to bring your own amplifier so that you could hear yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's the problem. They would send from the board, they'd send a direct box back to you and plug into your amp for you. And then they would subsequently blow out your tweeter within the first 5 minutes. So now all you could hear is for the rest of the gig. So your recourse was look like a tool and have a big pair of headphones on because they didn't have those little behind the ear things that they have now, you know, or go back to lugging around all of the stuff that you did before, which is where I went back with it. And well, the whole reason why I got them though was not for gigging. I got them for practicing because when I first got married, I had to move in an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
You needed to, you know, you know yourself, drums are not conducive to apartment living. It's just not
that. I didn't know that. You sure?
Oh, boy. I'll tell you. But yeah. So, you've had an illustrious career. When did you decide? I know I came into teaching about 20 years ago. I for a long time, resisted teaching, even though Al Miller, for the last couple of years that I was taking with him, he was teaching me how to teach more than he was teaching me how to do anything else. You know? So, what was, when did you decide that you were going to teach?
Circumstances were basically we were doing, when I came off the road, I met the guys at Long Island Drum, and they invited me, well, did you want to teach? They taught me how to teach, set up schedule and stuff like that, which I didn't know anything about that. And I was looking at it as a form of banking finance and still being able to play.
Right.
So the plane went down. There wasn't a lot of gigs or whatever. And so I wound up teaching, and then I wound up doing the arts and ed at the same time with a gentleman named John DeVol that had a company called Arts Horizons in the city. Because I was still trying to sub and do things on Broadway, you know, to make some finance. And then I was private teaching as well. So that's how I got into the private teaching. And I learned how to put schedules together. And I was going door to door. I wasn't teaching at my house. Later on, I tried to get coach people to come to my house, but I found out I could do maybe a little better on the road. And I sort of grew into having, you know, getting students and things of that nature. Right now, I'm not even, I have maybe two students, which is more than enough. I'm not really teaching full-time like that. I don't know if I wanted to worry about full-time students as much anymore, because, you know, every student is an individual.
Right.
And unfortunately, they're under a preconception that you just come to lesson and you go home. So in between lesson, you don't do anything. It used to be that way on the road, man. I used to like almost fall asleep on the students. It's like, oh, because it's like, oh, here we go again. You know, they didn't practice. So, but the idea was to motivate them to practice.
Right.
And
right.
to play. So that, and I would tell parents, just the motivation should not come from me. It should come from your son or daughter. And all you want, all I'm trying to do is implant it in them that they want to practice and play. And then I found out how to divide the lesson up. So it was rudiments, reading, and playing. So within that, you know, and even in the playing, I would have them start with what they'd like to do first, and then from there we can go to other things.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I found out when I was teaching piano lessons too. You can't really teach them something that they never hear and see or like, or other than when they come to you.
Right, so, because they're not really going to be inspired to do that when they get home anyway.
Right. No. Right. And then I tell parents the same thing. I don't care if your son doesn't practice what I give him, but as long as they go home and play something. Like they listen to the radio when they're tapping at night or whatever.
Right.
At least they see the interest is there. You just got to get them to understand that the system of playing will help you become a better player.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. And then I study along the way too. So
it's all balance, I've found.
Mm-hmm.
Like for example, you discussed Nisman, and I've been coaching people for Nisman for a long time too. Mm-hmm. I've had some people get an all-state audition, got 100.
Wow.
Had a number of kids go to all county.
Yeah, right.
Stuff like that. The thing is, though, you have to balance even that. I've had students that the parents utilize my services specifically for NISP.
That's right.
So I get Cram them for yeah, yeah. I find NISP to be something that can be beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
However, I also find that it's got the propensity to crush the enthusiasm of students as well if you just push on that too much. It's drudgery.
Hey, I had one student cry. And so I thought maybe I did something wrong. He said, no, he was they were always upset over getting these scores and stuff, man. Yeah. And then NISMA, I judged a couple, adjudicated, and it was kind of rough. I mean, you know, because I didn't want to lie, because I was under, there's some guys I knew, teachers I knew, man, no, you're not lying. You did it or you didn't know. And when I had to be adjudicated when I was in college, it was the same way. Either you knew it or you don't know it.
Right.
There was no in between, you know, whatever. And I had a lot of students come through, and I would even ask them, which I guess I wasn't supposed to, because they didn't ask me to teach anyone.
Right.
Who's your teacher? Oh, I'm just studying in school. And You can't be a surgeon and don't go to college.
Right.
Oh, I'm gonna be a surgeon, so I'll watch TV and look at how they do it.
I'll go on YouTube.
Yeah, you know. No, man, you gotta have a teacher. So he'll be able to show you how quickly to do whatever you got to do. But you can't cram for, like, well, I've told the parents, I can do the best I can to help your student, but there's no cram course. I never took off for the summer because I didn't want to take music. No, that's something I did every day. You know, and I think the inspiration was to tell him, go and see people play.
Right.
But to me, that was the inspiration.
And
now they can do it even better with YouTube, man. You can go in there and see all these great musicians that are going past on. I mean, I love it going back and guys that analyze how Buddy Rich did. I'm like, watch this. This is great, man.
You know what? I think that's better for guys like us that already know what you're looking at.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. But a new guy, you wouldn't know, right? Yeah.
The big thing for me, I think live performance is the last bastion of hope for music.
Mm-hmm.
There's not that much money to be made in recording anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've come full circle, really, I think. Years ago, if there was somebody, say 100 years ago, you heard someone was a terrific piano player.
Mm-hmm.
What recourse did you have? Go buy a ticket.
Mm-hmm.
Go watch him play.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And there's something about live performance that is inspiring for people to get back in there and practice. I know it is for me.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Man, Steve Smith, I think it was he said one time, he said when Tony Williams came through, the practice room was filled the next day.
Yep.
Yeah, and when I saw the players too, it was like, oh, man, I want to go and practice. I don't want to be like that. Joe Morello, you know. So I guess today, I think the nice thing is, I told them, my students, you can go on YouTube and see these guys for free.
It's true. It's true. You can become inspired by that, for sure. But I don't think anything really beats the live performance. But once you've been there, then you're hungry for it. And tickets are expensive. So in their interim of saving for your next one, get on YouTube and start watching, you know? Yeah. And it's such a rich thing now. There's so much on YouTube.
Hey.
It's, well, anything you ever want to know.
Mm-hmm.
You got a problem with the refrigerator.
That's right.
Put the model number down there. And there's a handyman just showing you how to do it, you know? And whether you're fool enough to actually do that, I don't know. But for sure, you can pretty much see anything you ever wanted or never can forget.
You're right.
Anything that's on YouTube. Yeah. So, what are you doing playing these days?
These days, I'm going to play some more. We're doing a lot of, not clubs. We've been playing libraries and stuff like that. I've been trying to, not that I'm opposed to playing clubs, but for me, and I guess everyone that wants to be a drummer, it's a little bit different when you're playing for somebody else versus you're the leader.
Right.
So it wound up, I did want to be a leader, but since I'm not playing a melodic instrument, I would go back and hear all the other leaders that were able to lead a band, and like the Billies and that before him, the Art Blakeys, the Max Roaches, the Tony Williams when they started forming.
Right.
So how do you lead a band, man? Like, what do you know, because it's not like a singer or something like that. You're not the singer. They don't come home singing drum solos. So you figure out how to lead a band. So for me, it was always a lot of work to prepare the music,
right?
Get a staple of guys that could play it, even if I want to call something and have the music in front of them. No, I want this to be played that way if we didn't have a rehearsal.
Right.
So that we could get the work done. So lately, I've been working with other folks, and I'm going to be working on some more concerts. I want to work on another CD. And the pleasure is when I do have the chance to play I have some of the staple guys that I play with, Brian Carrot, Paul Ramsey on bass, lately Jennifer Vincent on bass, Misha Siganov, who plays piano. He's a Russian. He's real good. And I haven't been using percussion, just me playing the drums. So we played enough together that I could call a song and they know it.
Mm-hmm.
Even the originals that I've written. So that's good because I don't have to like rehearse those. We played them enough on live gigs or something so they know how the material goes.
Right.
So, but to get out and hustle to get a gig, that's a whole other different ball game because I'm not into the, I got to learn how to wear the promoter hat, you know. So when the guys come out, personally, I want them to come out for a certain amount of money and I know what they expect at the end of the night with the musicians playing.
Right.
And, you know, and it's a decent place to play, and we're not just playing so-called dives or something like that. But I think as a musician, that's a choice people have to make, whether you're not going to get paid the right amount of money. And then also, you got to realize, if you're on the business tip, I got to take the hit. I'm not going to tell them to take the hit because I got chiseled out of the money. And don't forget that Sandy hit right. So Sandy's cold, you know, Sandy. So I had a gig on a Monday night. So at the end of the night, the guy gets, well, you know, blah, blah, blah. I said, yeah, but you told me so-and-so. So, I mean, he stiffed me. But I didn't stiff the guys. I take the money out and pay the guys. But I didn't even go back and tell them, hey, man, I didn't get the money and complain like that. I just paid them the money. So for me, it was always a thing. I know I think it happened to Herbie Hancock once. He was on the road, and, you know, big band, and they didn't get paid. And Herbie, that's why he went down to a smaller group. But it was the same kind of concept. I didn't want to ever get out there and cheat the guys, not cheat them or cut them short because they didn't make money that they promised to pay me. So then, now you're talking about the whole business thing, how to do that, the business thing, and I don't want to do play-to-play and stuff like that, so.
Oh, that's getting ridiculous with these little promotional things where, what's the name of that one that's so prevalent? There's one that basically got a stranglehold on most of the clubs on the island, that including a place called the Crazy Donkey, which was the last time.
Farmingdale,
I guess?
Farmingdale. Because he asked about playing out there one time, and he heard me play or something, he wanted to bring the band out, and I didn't do it for some reason. I don't remember what the circumstances
were. I can tell you the reason why I didn't.
Yeah.
We had a gig. I was with a band at the time. I think it was a band called Liquid Picasso. We were there. We went. We got all set up. We went to sound check and everything else. And our manager comes out of the management office there, and she was heated.
Mm-hmm.
She said, "Get your stuff. We're leaving."
Mm.
unbeknownst to any of us, our manager was given tickets. You were supposed to sell these. There was 150 of them.
Wow. There.
And if you did not sell them by the night of your gig and give them the money for them, it was going to cost you $600 or $650 to play.
Mm.
I'm a professional, you know? Mm. It's supposed to go the other way, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. But the reason why a lot of that happens is because I think a lot of the onus of performance is now put on us. It used to be years ago, even if in the city, 2 o'clock in the morning, you're playing, there could be someone in that crowd that might just offer you something. Because there were scouts out there. Mm-hmm. They're not out there in the same way that they used to be. And the clubs themselves, it used to be if you played a certain club, like say Kenny's Castaways or something mm-hmm. like that, anyone that went in there did not necessarily have to know who was playing. You went there because the club had the reputation. They would be the ones that were going to fill the club.
That's right.
Right? Because they knew that if you were playing there, you had the stuff.
That's right.
You know? Now, it's all about paying rent.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So they want to guarantee the doors stay open. So they put the money end of it on us. And it is all but destroyed the scene here on the island.
Yeah. Well, you know, then that goes into the why I don't speak a lot about it, and because I don't want to seem like I've learned to always be trying to be positive about the music, even if it's a bad situation.
Right.
So I guess for me, when you say, well, what are you playing? It wound up that, well, I wound up teaching and the arts and education, because I knew I could make a certain sum of money if we hit that stage. I knew the library would pay me a certain budget when I hit that stage. And I said, well, I'm going to do that because I'm not going to go to a club and have to guarantee them some money before I get any money. Right. And then the old adage was like, well, then, you know, I think it was floating around YouTube one time. They were saying the same thing. Well, you don't go to Macy's. And Macy's said, well, you're not going to get paid depending on how many people you bring to the door. You know, you got to bring your friends in.
It's
your
insane.
Your friends can't support right. you. So once in a while, I have done it for other people, but they always guaranteed me some kind of money at the end. And I did the other day.
I've done the same thing where I've gotten money independently of anyone else because I was filling in for someone. So
yeah, yeah. So I did one not too long in the city for a woman friend, and she told me this daughter thing. I said, oh, man. So she paid me, and I didn't have to bring anything, which was nice. So all of my sticks and cymbals and I think my snare drum. So that was nice. And she paid me well at the end of the night, but I know she took a hit because there wasn't a lot of people there. Yeah. But I think the problem is that the musicians at some points will have to learn that and that goes back earlier what we were saying before. If you get into it as a hobby, then I can see, and I've worked for guys that do it for a hobby, and they wind up with doctors and lawyers and etc.
Right.
So when the guy calls me to do the gig, and I realize he's a dentist, and so I tell him how much I want. Well, we can't pay. Well, look, he's a dentist and a doctor. I mean, if I went to a dentist or a doctor or a plumber, hey man, a plumber, especially the plumber, he was the one that told me about.
Oh boy.
Remember the value that you're worth.
That's
he
right.
He came to my house. I didn't care if he had a degree or not. And he charged me. He thought I had money under my pillow. Like, just to give him thousands of dollars. I said, whoa, you know. So I learned, and I was telling my wife, as a musician, you got to think the same way. No, this is what I'm worth. I'm not trying to cheat you, and I don't want you to cheat me. No, I want X amount of dollars to do the gig.
That's it,
you know. And I work with you, but no, I'm not taking the drums out and this. And then you wouldn't even thought about hiring me if I couldn't do the gig.
Right.
Yeah, so it's not trying to be tainted or anything like that. But the gigs are, in a way, the world is getting smaller, which means the gigs are getting smaller in one sense, because the ones I see that fill up the big arenas and stuff already got an entourage. They got the whole PR in place and stuff. And a lot of them are already seasoned players.
Right.
Specifically, like we were in the jazz, the Herbie Hancock's and the Wayne Shorters, well, they're already set already, you know, so they can go out and command X amount of dollars. I went and saw, I think it was Wayne. It was like $80 ticket. I said, whoa, $80 tickets to go see Wayne. Not that I didn't want to see him. It was like $80. It was like $80 ticket at Carnegie Hall. I went to see, you know, and it's like, wow. You know, I went and saw him and stuff. And I realized that either you're going to be in one or two, like, margins. Either you're going to go for the real high-end tech stuff or where you can really get some money out of this thing, or you wind up just playing little clubs and stuff. Only because you want to play and you want to be able to do that stuff. And then hopefully you'll get called for the bigger ones where you get the big arenas and stuff. But there aren't that many super, I guess there are and there aren't as far as as far as players are concerned, superstars, because it all depends on what genre you're playing. So maybe, you know, country and western, yeah, they use musicians. So right. Hip-hop, they're using some musicians, but not like it used to be. R&B, maybe, yeah, they use some musicians, you know. So
well, again, live, yeah, a lot of it's machine when they record.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. You know? And then they're not even the same players on the records online.
It's just not fantastic to see one person on stage.
That's sure isn't,
you know.
It sure isn't. And so now you're talking about an arena budget, a Madison Square budget, you know. Wow. And sometimes I can't even imagine that, like, you know, this is like, you know, thousands of dollars or whatever. But hey, man, that's if you're in the music business. I tell my students, you know, you got to be prepared for the ups and downs, the lows and the highs.
Right.
And don't ever get discouraged and think that you're not worth anything because it didn't work out. Because, I mean, it happened to me a couple times. Like, I felt like, oh, man, I'm not worth anything. I mean, I got fired or this and that, you know, whatever happens. And then you start doubting yourself. Am I okay? And like, again, I read articles about guys how the band broke up. It's like it hurt them so bad and they tried hard. And so you try and meet the ones that have been in it long enough. And most right. of them, if they're honest and nice, they'll let you know about that. Man, don't ever give up. Don't ever think that you're bad. Just keep out there plugging and doing it. And, you know, ask the ones that you like, if they're on, they'll tell you how they made it. You know, hopefully it's the correct way. But, you know, I listen to a lot of artists that I always like, well, how'd you do this? And how'd you do that? How was it like doing this? Not because I was trying to get in a mood with them like that, but I want to figure out how am I going to be able to navigate this right. thing if yeah. I was going to be in it for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, you know? Yeah. So right. I've been blessed to do it as a career, and I never thought, it got pretty bad at one point, and that's when the Broadway show thing came in. So I wasn't going to say, nah, man, I don't want to play no Broadway show. Hey, I was getting a paycheck. I was able to take care of my family, you know, pay my bills. I said, I like this thing. And the only bad thing I did is that I didn't stay active trying to get gigs when, like, I didn't have any work. Because then, oh, well, I thought you were doing a Broadway show.
Yeah, you fall off network pretty quick.
Yeah. So I found, no, keep networking. Like, you don't have. Right. In fact, some guys don't even tell them you got a steady gig because then their mind says, oh, well, you got a steady gig. You don't need to come out here and work. Yeah.
Right.
So I've learned that. Don't say it about, like you don't need work. No. Call me, man. You live on Long Island. Call me. Let me decide whether I don't want to go in Manhattan.
Right.
Don't say, well, you live on Long Island and it's too far and you don't want to do it. No. Let me decide.
Sometimes you can't say Long Island to
That's
begin
right.
with.
I don't know about you, but I remember when I had the area code 516, they said, where's that? Well, I said, it's not on the moon. But because if you didn't have a 212-718, they figure you so far out.
You know, there's many spots here on the island where you can clearly view Manhattan from here. You know, I mean, you go to Manhattan, you go onto a 25A over by where the Americana is over
that's
there.
Right, that's right,
you
that's
just
right.
you see the entire thing splayed out for you while you're waiting for that light.
That's right. Yeah.
But well, that's what we are. We're a suburb of the city,
yeah.
you know? That's why there's so much talent. You know, we're such a hotbed, particularly for drummers,
mm-hmm.
here on Long Island, which you have to, know you're a Long Island when you say on Long Island.
Yeah, right. I'm trying to think of the drummer's name. I just met him. He's the one that's doing Stomp. He's out of Ronkonkoma or whatever it is, too. Just met him, too. And we were looking at each other, and I said, yeah, I think we met before. I can't think of his name. I have to look at his name, but he's doing Stomp. But he's out here from Long Island.
Really?
So
yeah.
Stomp came out here to, where did I go see Stomp? Out in Suffolk County. And I wanted to go see the play again. And so
right.
it was nice. Yeah,
it's a little bit more downtown now, right?
Stomp, they've been going for years, man, at the Orpheum Theater downtown Manhattan. But the one they came out here and
yeah.
they did one out here on Long Island. They did for 2 days, and I wanted to go see the show again.
Well, they might have done it at... You
Plano.
Know they do a lot of
that. Suffolk County.
It's in Suffolk. What's
County.
In Suffolk? Oh, okay.
It was at Suffolk County. They
I thought it might have been a post.
No. I'm surprised too. Yeah, no, they were out in Suffolk. Patchogue Theater.
Okay.
And so I went out to the Patchogue.
Right.
I went out to see him at Patchogue. You know, I love the show because it's all about rhythm.
Right.
And actually, they were one of the ones that gave me some ideas when we started an arts and education thing. I wanted to put some rhythm things together and figure out how I could exploit that. And we wound up getting bucket players. I wound up getting a bucket. Being able to teach bucket playing. But,
that's why I thought it was still around. I was confusing that with the Blue Man Group.
Yeah, the Blue Man Troop is still playing too, yeah.
Yeah
so
yeah.
Blue Man came out, right. Stomp, Tap Dog came out.
Right.
And so all these, which is great for us, it was rhythm shows. They were based on rhythm. I was trying to find this guy's number. No, I got it in my phone. It was based on rhythm. So what was nice about it was, as a drummer, that was great. That was good for the rhythm section. And then when Drumline came out, I had students because they wanted to play like Drumline. Oh, yeah. And Drumline, he wasn't really playing.
It would have been nice if they picked someone who knew how to play
drums. Yeah.
I mean, I tell my students is, listen, what you got to do is, if you ever want to know if someone's playing, you got to see the face and the hands at the same time. It's easier with a piano because this is this ginormous thing just around them, so you can't see their hands. But yeah. Nick Cannon's just going, yeah, okay, whatever.
But, you know, I got students because they want to be like Drumline. But right. To me, that was a good thing for the drummers and the drumming community. That now we got a movie based off of playing drums, you know, and being a drummer and something like that.
That Whiplash. Whiplash?
So Whiplash, that was like a horrible, but, you know, Whiplash and stuff. But, you know, for what it was worth, if it maybe motivated somebody to see and want to play some percussion and drums, that's a good thing. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a good thing. So Stomp was like that. And I'm one of the most students to see Stomp and get interested in playing rhythms and tapping and playing and you know, motivating the art form. You know, that's what it's about, motivating the art form. So,
yeah.
Well,
well, you're a motivating guy. So my eventual plan with this podcast is to include also playing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a video aspect of it. I'd like this to be something like almost like a self-encapsulated TV show about drums. It's drum specific.
Yes,
my podcast. And all you gotta do is go on there and see some of the people I've had on there, and you might know some of them. A lot of these guys are like journeymen from Long Island. I don't know if you ever knew Frank Bellucci.
I know Frank a little bit.
Yeah.
Frank's a nice guy. Real nice person. Personality and everything. Yeah, he's got a lot of stuff going for him, you know. Frank's good.
He's a good dude. But you're in good company. I've had some good people, but I've had a tremendous time talking to you. I would love to invite you back again.
Oh, man. Anytime you want to come back and play, that'd be great, man.
That'd be great.
Because anything that we can do to promote the art form of drumming,
yes,
it's the main thing. So hopefully, you know, it could be eclectic enough, have a whole different people so they can hear a lot of different things, you know. And the blessing I had for me, I think, was that for some reason I wanted to hear a lot of different drums and drumming. And so a lot of the players like Will Calhoun and them, you know, they started like playing different stuff. And Will, you know, I mean, Living Color has always been to me one of the hippest bands.
They play the
legacy of them is great because they can play this and they play that and they hear all these different music. Now they got Living Color that plays this type.
Well, even within the same album, some of their songs are so different. I mean, you got like Love Rears Its Ugly Head. That's a tremendous song, you know? You put that right up against that song, Solace of You.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same album. At least I think it is. Yeah. I'm pretty sure it is. But just...
And he's experimenting. I like because he experimented with different stuff. I saw with the wave drum and stuff like that. So that's what we're doing now. We're living in a great age where we can get all these different sounds, and I don't have to own all these different instruments because now I can get them sampled, you know, and now be able to play all these different sounds. So when I'm at the keyboard, I said, that's slick. I can sound like this. Yeah.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah. So I like that when you're going back to the sample thing, I think that's what got me into it. Because being into electronics through my father, that I was never opposed to the whole digital media that now we call digital media,
right,
where the whole electronic thing and come up with different sounds and allows one to paint all kind of different palette of sounds. And that led me to see, no, I want to hear this, I'm going to hear all these different types of music, so that I just wanted to be a part of me. So if I need it, it's there. I said, oh no, I want that Eastern sound, that Western sound, this kind of sound over there and there. And I found that to be, to me, more rewarding in the music for me. And I think it would translate to the audience. They will hear something that they didn't hear before, because other than, you don't have to hear 2 and 4 all the time just to elevate yourself.
Right.
You know, I'm talking about the young people in society. Right. They'll understand that this music is really universal for real. And you need to hear different other types of music that will help you become a better person, hopefully.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been a tremendous interview. Again, I want to invite you back.
All right. Anytime.
But this has been D's Practice Pad. And I've enjoyed talking to my good man.
Napoleon Rebels Bay.
Yes. It's been a pleasure, sir.
Thank you so much. And before I go, can I say one thing to you?
Yes.
One thing? That's enough.